Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More at dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look back at the popular children's book, The Phantom Tollbooth.
First, though, use of force reports by the Milwaukee Police Department have more than doubled so far this year.
The increase is the result of a new approach to the way the police department keeps track of these incidents.
The department was heavily scrutinized last year and attracted the attention of the federal government after several accusations of excessive force hit the media. Here with us to talk about the Milwaukee Police Department's new approach to using and reporting force is Gita Lousby. She's an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gita, thanks for joining us.
No problem, guys. Nice to be here.
What does this new report have to say about the use of force in the Milwaukee Police Department?
Well, it's up. Obviously, we only have the first half of this year so far, and we can compare that to last year, and it's up about 2.5 times. So we had 225 in the first half of 2012, and we've had 538 so far in 2013. So like I said, up more than twice.
Now, obviously, a change like that catches the eye. Tell us a little bit about what is behind that jump.
Yeah, so what police are stressing is mainly that this is on paper. So it's not so much that the police are using more force than they were last year. It's a matter of what gets reported and the fact that these now have to be reported in a separate report. So previously, nearly all of these incidents were part of a regular report, but police are required to file a separate report when they use force. And what was required to be reported earlier was not quite as strict as what is now, and that partially has to do with the definition of what you consider a use of force compared to what was previously considered use of force. So previously, police were mainly considering a use of force if it involved a weapon. So you have a gun, you have a baton, something else, a taser. Now it also covers hands-on uses of force, so if they throw somebody to the ground or deliver strikes to their heads or somewhere else, they have to report it. And previously, it was mainly if people were actually injured. Now, if somebody claims they're injured, it still has to be reported in a separate incident. And also, if police are just using anything that's defined as a use of force. So it's a little bit tighter as far as the reporting requirements. So that's what police are saying. Basically, it's the explanation for why the numbers are up.
Sounds like there were some pretty controversial cases using force by the Milwaukee police last year, things that hit the media, and might have been the reason behind some of this rejigging of things. Is that right?
Yeah, they made no beef about that. The police chief held some training earlier this year, police chief Ed Flynn, where he basically explained that the public obviously became concerned after seeing a bunch of these incidents. There were all of them basically were caught on tape, which was part of the problem. When you have it on tape and you're seeing somebody who's lying face down on the pavement and they're getting struck on the side of the head while they're lying face down, that looks pretty bad to people. And like he sort of stressed in these seminars, unlawful and lawful use of force, they look the same to the public. It looks pretty bad because we're considering as the public, we're just thinking somebody's being made to do something that they're not doing voluntarily. So it's a use of force. And that's not really how police was seeing it. So we had one guy who was accused of being a drunk driver who was driving recklessly in downtown Milwaukee who got these strikes that I was talking about here. Another woman who got fairly argumentative with police where somebody ended up punching her in the face. And, you know, clearly she wasn't exerting any kind of physical threat to this officer. And part of the policy is you're not supposed to strike somebody who is just confronting you verbally as an officer. And so these are things that are kind of being clarified, but the fact that the public got a hold of, you know, was able to see this stuff on video, either on TV or, you know, through our website, it just looked bad and it forced them into a position where they had to explain it. And then some of these incidents, they didn't have reports on them. And so, you know, obviously it looks like either they're trying to hide it or that they don't know what's going on. So clearly that was something that needed to change.
So after cases like these and this move to change how Milwaukee police report use of force, do you think that this helps the police department, makes them look proactive, or does it shine a spotlight and sort of make them look like they need shaping up?
Well, possibly a little bit of both. obviously, the big concern on their end, there is a public trust issue here that they want to make sure that they're maintaining the public's trust in, you know, we're not abusing our power. On the other hand, they have bigger concerns, which is they don't want the Federal Department of Justice to come in and start taking over and saying, look, the way that you guys are treating citizens here is not right, so we need somebody else to come in and monitor you. That would be, first of all, really expensive, and second, it would be a little bit of a failure of the leadership to, you know, have the federal government come in and say, you need to have somebody else keep track of you, essentially, because you're not capable of doing these troubleshooting yourself and taking care of your own problems. So I think it's a little bit of both, but obviously there's a big liability in here that it's pretty expensive if you get the government to come in and force you to enter into a legal agreement and you have to have an outside independent company come in and monitor your compliance with this. So that could be pretty expensive. And we're talking several million dollars every year. And there's really no end to a process like that. You don't know how long it would keep going on for. And obviously, if you have a contractor who's doing this, as the police chief points out, they may not have a whole lot of incentive to find you in compliance because the minute they find you in compliance, they're sort of out of work. So that kind of prolonged process he would prefer to avoid.
Now, Milwaukee is obviously far from the first city recently to run into problems with its police force and having some high-profile cases that have drawn media attention. Do you think that Milwaukee, you know, is in a position where its policies sort of needed rejigging, or is it pretty much in step with what other police departments across the country have been doing in terms of force?
Right. When it came to use of force, what Milwaukee police did was essentially do a survey of other departments and how their policies kind of compared to what they were doing here in Milwaukee. And they found that most of them did define these hands-on uses of force as a use of force that needed to be reported. And so as a result of that, they went in and changed that. A big point that the police chief was making, too, was, you know, you go, of course, you're supposed to go according to policy, but that's just part of it. If you get a number of incidents that are caught on tape that make you look bad, the federal government may still come in. It may be three incidents out of 1,000, but if they look bad enough, the federal government may still come in and take a look at you. So it's important to at least send the signal to the federal government that, you know, we're paying attention to this and we're trying to do something about it, and here's what our policy says. So they clearly found a need to kind of brush up on that to avoid a more imminent threat to have the federal government come in and do a formal investigation.
Key, did you have a sense of how these new numbers are being digested in Milwaukee today?
I think a lot of people are taking, from what I can see on our comments on our website, people are taking the chief's words for it in, you know, this is a reporting requirement that changed. So we don't necessarily see that, you know, people are questioning that. Of course, there will always be people who will say, well, they're doctoring the books. But overall, I think people, you know, understand that they're doing this. Some are seeing it as a transparency thing. But obviously, you'll always have people who have seen the videos who will say, well, this may be what they say, but we saw in the video that people were pretty crude in these instances here. So there will be some people who would choose to believe the videos over maybe what the police are saying.
All right. Well, Gita, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Gita Lousby, investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back to talk about a new documentary on the children's book, The Phantom Toll Booth. This is Central Time.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Phantom Toll Booth came out a little more than a half century ago. It's become a classic children's book passed on from generation to generation.
Yeah, I read it as a kid. It stuck with me. And just last year, I read it to my kids, and that was a great experience. The creators of the book, though, author Norton Juster and illustrator Jules Pfeiffer, didn't really know it was going to stick around for so long. And our next guest tells that story. Hannah Jant is with us now. She's the director of the new documentary, The Phantom Toll Booth, Beyond Expectations. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's have a clip from the documentary. This is author Norton Juster. He's reading from the description of his main character, Milo.
It seems to me that almost everything is a waste of time, he remarked one day as he walked dejectedly home from school. I can't see the point in learning to solve useless problems or subtracting turnips from turnips or knowing where Ethiopia is, or how to spell February. And since no one bothered to explain otherwise, he regarded the process of seeking knowledge as the greatest waste of time of all.
And Milo spends the rest of the book learning the opposite lesson. Hannah, before we get into the Phantom Tollbooth, what made you want to tell the story behind the book?
There were a couple of things. One was simply meeting Norton Jester and Jules Pfeiffer, who one thing that the documentary charts is their long-standing friendship and collaboration. And they have an incredible rapport, and they're very funny. And they're this wonderful combination of accomplished and witty and wise and incredibly approachable and human. And that, for me, fit the whole mode of the Phantom Tollbooth so well that I was thrilled to be able to spend more time with them and get to know them and the backstory. And then the second thing was that I hadn't read the book since I was a child. And I read it on a bus. I read it for 4 hours straight. And I laughed out loud to myself on this bus. And I found there were so many new things that I found in it. And I found the book so funny and warm that the fact that it had stood up after so much time, both in my life and from when it was written in the 50s, seemed really remarkable.
Well, and I learned this from your documentary. We have this children's book written by a guy who never planned to write a children's book, illustrated by a political cartoonist who says he looked down on children's books and illustrating those. How did those two guys create such a lasting children's book?
Yeah, so one of the things that's talked about in the film is this idea that there's quite a few famous children's book authors who weren't writing for children, whose intention wasn't children's books per se, who just happened to be writing about their own interests that manifest itself into a children's form. And that seems to be the case with Norton Jester. And so they got together in Brooklyn. And like you say, Norton Jester was an architect at the time, living in Brooklyn Heights. And Jules Pfeiffer was busily trying to overtake the government through his satirical cartoons at the Village Voice. And they got together because they lived together and, you know, really enjoyed each other's company. And Norton started writing this book and Jules started illustrating it. And they ended up having a really remarkable and enviable collaboration that was extremely organic, extremely well-suited.
Well, and one thing that occurred to me rereading the book to my kids last year was this is not a kid's book that talks down to kids anyway. I mean, there's some pretty complicated, wacky wordplay and concept play in there.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the reasons that it ends up being pretty timeless, is that I think that you can enjoy it at a bunch of different ages. You know, the fact that I found it funny again, the fact that I got wordplay that I didn't get before. And the fact that, I mean, one of the things that they ran into when they tried to get it published was there was a bunch of people that said, what age group is this for? And then they said, this is problematic because it's unclear that it's for a particular age group. And if it isn't for a particular age group, we can't market it. You know, we can't tell, you know, who it's for. And, of course, that ends up being the thing that makes it a classic. But at the time, it made it something that was, you know, a problem.
Now, you mentioned the friendship between author Norton Jester and the illustrator Jules Pfeiffer, and it really shows through watching the documentary. But can you talk about what it was like observing this 50-plus year friendship in action?
I think one of the things that I loved was that on camera and off camera were exactly the same.
Well, so they were not playing for the camera on this thing?
No, I mean, they ham it up a little bit, partly because they're used to, you know, they're used to talking to people about their collaboration whenever they've done book tours or anything. But aside from a little bit of hamming up, everything was exactly the same. And I think that was the thing that charmed me so much, is that I didn't feel like I was getting some type of performance or some type of false thing. I felt like they were being really genuine.
And talk about them as they point out, and other people point out in your documentary, these guys are opposites in some significant ways. Talk about that.
Well, it's funny. David Hyde Pierce talks about that in the documentary. And I have to be honest, I half agree.
Okay.
I think that they are, they're quite different in their presence. Jules is very tall and a little more, stern isn't the right word, but a little more, Norton is just, he's very jovial. He's very warm and open and he loves to laugh. And, but they both have this incredible combination of very, very sharp wit and incredible warmth and humanity. And so I see that similarity more, actually, because I think that's a pretty rare combination to have somebody who's incredibly perceptive, incredibly witty, but also has a generosity and warmth. Oftentimes those don't go that well together.
And you interview some other children's authors in the book, and they point out, and this is what how I thought it worked. Usually somebody writes a book, the publisher finds an illustrator, or there's a famous illustrator who has great drawings and they find somebody to come and write a book around it. That's not how it worked with these guys. How did they collaborate in the making of the Phantom Toll Booth?
Yeah, so I think they had a pretty exceptional collaboration. They, as far as I can tell, it happened very organically. They were in the same house. Norton was showing Jules his writings. Jules loved it, and he loved the humor, and he started doing illustrations for it. And like you say, usually a book isn't prepared with the author and the illustrator together. Like you say, usually there's the book first or there's the illustrations first. And so one of the things that Eric Carle, the author-illustrator of children's books, talks about in the documentary is that it's very rare to have somebody, he says, present a whole package, something that has both developed. And it makes it quite special because it makes it really like a whole piece that was developed together, that was presented together, that was really a collaboration from the beginning.
Well, you mentioned that publishers didn't see the writing as age-appropriate or fitting a particular age group. How did they feel about Jules Pfeiffer's illustrations? Because that's really unusual for a kid's book.
Yeah, I actually don't know the answer to that. No one has told me about the reception that Jules' drawings got. But Jules talks about how he did them very much in the tradition of English children's illustrations. So like Alice in Wonderland, this kind of pen-line sketchy drawing that was quite typical to that time. And he says that he was inspired partly by an illustrator called Edward Artizon. And he felt that Norton's writing was very much in the English tradition, like Alice in Wonderland, and the book has been called The American Alice in Wonderland. So he developed a style that was kind of a combination of the satirical cartoons that he was doing and the combination of these English illustrations that he was drawing from.
Well, you mentioned how they kind of worked together and this all came out organically. I can't imagine a Phantom Toll Booth, you know, having somebody else come in and illustrate it ever. That's just one book where it wouldn't make a bit of sense.
Yeah, I agree. And that was actually one thing that was difficult in making the documentary, is that we wanted to create some animations and we wanted to create a visual style. And Jules's illustrations are so iconic and so appropriate that it was hard to think about putting any other type of visuals to the books that weren't his.
I can see that. And speaking of the making of the documentary, you did some things differently. You're doing this 50-year-old book, but some cutting-edge stuff. This is a kick-started documentary, right?
Yeah. So that was a really exciting thing for us. I personally believe that this was a very well-suited Kickstarter project, and there's a couple reasons. I mean, Kickstarter does this amazing thing. Basically, it allows me to get in touch with the audience for this film directly. So I don't have to go through commissioners. I don't have to go through people who will look at the film and say, is this a film that is marketable? Is this a film that we can connect to this or that people? Basically, the audience, by their support, tells us whether or not this is a film that they would like to see. And that seemed particularly fitting to the Phantom Toll Booth, which is such a personal thing for people. I mean, people love this book, and they have a very personal relationship to it. I get I get so many emails where people tell me that they named their kids Milo, or that they got married because of the book, or that they have a dog named Hawk. And so to be able to reach our audience on a personal, independent basis seems like a really great fit for the film.
All right. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been fun.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Hannah Jayanti, director of The Phantom Tollbooth, Beyond Expectations.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a look at the photojournalism of the war in Vietnam.
And a self-described rogue sociologist takes us on a tour of America's urban underground economies.
And we'll hear about the computer game Minecraft. Our guest calls it the most creative video game ever.
All that and a look at the news of the day coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, whether or not you believe in them, Wisconsin has its share of scary stories and spooky places.
For today's Wisconsin Life segment, producer Aubrey Ralph recently visited a hotel that has been welcoming guests and ghosts for decades.
My friends Cynthia, Tessa, and I are on our way to the Retlaw Plaza Hotel in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. It was built in the early 20s by hotel magnate Walter Schrader. Retlaw is Walter, spelled backwards. The hotel was once a jewel of the city, but that's not why we're here. We're here because we've heard that Walter, almost 50 years after his death, still walks the halls. Opened in March of 1923, the hotel really was a jewel, built from the finest materials available. It played host to the rich and famous, and with the secret tunnel leading to the secret bar across the street, it was also home to those who just wanted a prohibition-defying drink before bed. With its ornate chandeliers and sculpted plaster, it could be the set for any number of movies, but now it seems to be home to a ghost story.
There it is, Aubrey, right?
Yes. After checking in, okay. The first thing I want to do is talk to the staff.
Has anything weird ever happened to you?
Well, yeah, my cups have gone flying off my cart before.
Really?
Yeah. I was in a room and all of a sudden I heard my cups go flying and I looked and they were like across the hallway.
In the kitchen one time we were sitting there and all of a sudden the ice machine opened up and flung ice out of it. Like it never happens. We've never seen that happen before and it just flung right out of there. We like to joke around and say that it's Walter that's doing it.
Then it's off to check out our rooms. Mine looks pretty much like any room in an old hotel. No bleeding walls or anything. Although when I turn on my TV, a show about ghost hunting is on. After a late dinner, we meet back up to go exploring. The place is mostly quiet, and we search every nook and cranny of the 8 floors, hoping to see or feel something. In a few places, our recorders pick up a lot of interference, but that's about it. Then it's off to bed. Even though my room is rumored to be one of the most haunted, I slept like a baby, with none of the reported hair-pulling or ghostly banging, but it was a different story for Tessa.
So I was tossing and turning until about 2:30 this morning, and I was just about to doze off, and all of a sudden I got a really strong smell of stale cigarettes in my face. And so my heart started pounding immediately. So I definitely think there's something happening in this hotel.
All right, and that's 717 and 714?
Okay, all right.
Maybe every old building is haunted by the memory of its years. Time has weight, and it forces old pipes to moan and foundations to creak. But here, maybe, just maybe, there is something more. Something that smells of tobacco and possesses a mischievous heart.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more info at wisconsinlife.org. Well, we have two of our intrepid explorers here with us now. Aubrey Ralph is next to me. He's a producer here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, Aubrey.
Hey.
Cynthia Schuster's here. She's a producer and a host. You may have heard her hosting this show in the past. Cynthia, good to see you there again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all right. We got your taste of what the hotel was like. Aubrey, Cynthia, anything strike you first on walking in the door there?
No. I mean, I thought it was a cute, charming place, but I didn't get any spooks.
All right. And give us a little more of the atmosphere, Aubrey. I mean, no bleeding walls. You said that
no
in the piece.
No bleeding walls.
You sounded disappointed.
It was unshining
I was a little disappointed. Yeah, actually, the kind of one of the spookier things that happened was driving up to the place. It used to be a Ramada, and it's the kind of hotel that has the sign on the top of it. Mm-hmm. And it was all the neon was kind of cracked, and some of the letters were out. So it was that was a little creepy going into it.
Now, what we heard from the staff there now, but are there other legends and spooky things that are rumored to have happened at the hotel?
All kinds of stuff. The reason I chose the room I did was because I think 15 years ago, guests reported hearing all this crazy banging and screaming coming from the seventh floor, and maintenance went up and tracked it down to that room, and somebody was like screaming in there and then kicking on the door. And he could feel just the power of the kicks on the door, and like his key would not open it, so he couldn't get in there. And all of a sudden it stopped, and the key started working, and he went in, and like, of course, nobody's in there. Mm-hmm. There's no marks on the door.
Now, I hate to be Johnny Skeptic, but if I worked at this hotel, I'd be playing tricks on my coworkers all the time. Is there any thought that it could just be pranksters?
I met a woman in the bar the night that we were there, and she said a week ago... she had come back in the night and all of the furniture on the seventh floor was turned upside down. Hmm. And I suspect that was probably not ghosts that did that.
Now, Cynthia, we heard in the piece that Aubrey slept like a baby, a happy baby. Tessa had trouble. You, any weirdnesses?
I was aided by the fact that I worked with the Joy Cardine show that morning. So I had been up since 4 and I slept like a baby as well. We and Aubrey had me scouting out the building up until about 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night. So I was pretty well pooped, and Tessa, I think, was the only one who had trouble and suspected something.
Now, you knew her before this incident. Is she easily scared? Were you surprised about how she reacted?
She admits, she said going into this, I'm easily spooked by this kind of stuff. I was a little bit unsure as to whether she would join us, but she did, and I'm very glad she did, because honestly, I didn't want to spend the night alone in a hotel. You're very brave, Aubrey, for staying alone in your room.
And Aubrey, did you talk to any of the other guests there when you stayed?
The only woman I talked to was in the bar that night, and that's really about it. I specifically did not want to bug guests, because I figured it would be kind of inappropriate. And
you don't want to scare away the clientele.
No.
Did you guys feel a little bit like Scooby-Doo and the gang?
I did,
yeah, for sure.
We even had a van.
Really?
We did, yeah.
The mystery machine.
WPR mystery machine.
But at no point did you tackle Don Knotts in a ghost outfit.
No crooked real estate developers at all, as far as I know.
All right, so you're interested in paranormal type stuff.
Sure.
We know this behind the scenes here. Is this a place that you suggest ghost hunters, ghost aficionados should check out?
It's a really pretty hotel, so, nothing happened to me, but, I mean, not to say that somebody else wouldn't have a different experience, so sure.
Would you want to go and try to, like, draw the ghosts out ever? I mean, you just went and slept.
I just went and slept, yeah.
I think the first step is to split up, if I remember my Scooby-Doo
that's,
correctly.
That's correct. And we didn't split up, no. Maybe that would have helped.
Okay. And just talk about the ambiance. I mean, ghosts aside, this is an older hotel, which can be pretty cool, or it can be pretty seedy. What was your take on it?
It's got these ornate chandeliers, and there's ballrooms on the second floor. I love that kind of stuff, and it sort of harkens back to an era that I wish I could have been a part of in a way. Just this beautiful architecture and interior design. But being alone on the second floor, kind of scouting out those ballrooms, which are reportedly haunted as well, I was kind of a little bit on edge as we peeked into the dark rooms. And I tried to use flash photography to see if I could, if it would pick anything up. That aside, even if you went into there not knowing that this is rumored to be a haunted hotel, I think you would find it very charming.
Okay, charming, if a bit haunted. And I think you had a couple Shining references in your piece, Aubrey.
Two or three.
Was it, if I'm picturing the Shining Hotel, Is that the kind of old-fashioned we're talking about, or is this more of a Wisconsin thing?
It's more of a Wisconsin thing. I mean, it looks very much like, I guess, any sort of 1920s building, you know, square, seven or eight floors or so, and, you know, not really distinct, other than the sign on the metal posts on top, not very distinctive.
All right. Each of you, one at a time, would you go back to the Retlaw?
Yeah.
And maybe do a little more stirring around trying to find the ghost?
I missed the pool room. That some spooky stuff supposedly happened in the pool room, and I only discovered that we had missed that after I'd been hanging out in the bar for a little bit, and I was just tired, and, you know.
See, that's where Walter was that night. Would you go back, Cynthia?
Same deal, but I wouldn't miss out on the late night old fashioned and storytelling around around the bar. So.
But would you have to have a roommate?
I would. I still need to hold someone's hand.
All right, Cynthia, thanks a lot for coming back to the show.
Thanks.
And Aubrey, you too.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Aubrey Ralph, producer here at WPR. Cynthia Schuster, producer and host here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we'll check the headlines, then we'll talk to a guest about how to develop our communities in spite of dysfunction in Washington. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking about a new bike safety bill in Wisconsin.
First, a little over a week after the government ended its shutdown and avoided default, Rich Harwood of the Harwood Institute is launching a campaign, says he's reclaiming Main Street.
The campaign starts today in Washington, D.C., and Rich will be traveling the country encouraging Americans to focus on enhancing their own communities in spite of the dysfunction in the nation's capital. Rich Harwood is the president and founder of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. Rich, thanks for being with us.
Veronica, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your Reclaiming Main Street campaign. What's the goal?
Well, the goal is that, you know, the government shutdown yet again reminded us about how divided we can be, how our public discourse focuses so much on tearing one another down and focuses so much on what we're against. And I think as I've traveled the country, what I think we need to remind ourselves right now is that in order for us to move past the impasse that we're in the country and to get past the kind of acrimony and divisiveness, we need to remind ourselves that community is a common enterprise, that it's about our shared challenges, it's about reaching for our shared aspirations, and that you can't go it alone in community, that we actually need each other in order to make progress on issues like food security, education, the environment, whatever issues that we're confronting in our individual communities.
So you think making the world a better place and America a better place starts with us? Forget the politicians?
No, we need the politicians and we need organizations and institutions. That's I feel pretty deeply about that. But I believe that those of us in our communities, individuals, groups, associations like Kiwanis or Rotary, organizations, you know, there are a lot of folks, Veronica, who want to take a different path in the country and in their communities to get together and solve problems. I think we need to identify those folks. I think we need to get together. And to your point, I think we need to send a clear message to those who want to continue the fight of acrimony and divisiveness that we're not going to put up with this any longer and that we expect them to take a different path with us.
Have you seen that dysfunction in Washington trickling down to, you know, the communities and in the main streets of America? Or do you think that, you know, we've been doing okay, we just need to sort of regroup?
Well, I think there are two competing realities happening right now, actually. I think, you know, when I go to communities, often the question I ask folks in those communities are, who are the leaders you trust and what are the organizations that you trust? And Veronica, when I asked that question 20 years ago, people would often give me a long list of leaders and organizations. And unfortunately, in many communities, in fact, most of the communities where we've been doing work, people can give me very few leaders and organizations that they actually believe are working in the interest of the common good, not simply their own good. And so I think there are fundamental challenges that exist in many communities. That said, I think in lots of communities, you can look at Detroit as one example, there are pockets of change that are starting to emerge that demonstrate that we still have the capacity, the know-how, the wisdom, the wherewithal, the willingness to come together and do things together.
Now you're focusing.
And so it's really both.
You're focusing on three key actions that people and communities can do to focus and move forward. Tell us about those. What are they?
Well, I think, you know, we've got to start. The best starting point is for us to articulate our shared aspirations that help us understand where it is that we really want to go. And in articulating those shared aspirations, we can begin to understand what we do hold in common and where we can begin our efforts. That's number one. Number two is I think we've got to get people together to do things, to do what I would call shared work, so that we can make a difference on the issues we care about. But equally important, Veronica, is that we can begin to rebuild our trust, meaningful relationships, and our confidence that we can actually come together and do things together. And the third thing I think we need to do is that we need to tell a different story about ourselves. Our story in public life right now in many communities is we can't get things done. We've tried that before. It won't work. We can't get people to work together. And so long as that's our ingrained narrative about ourselves, people will remain on the sidelines and feel as though there's no sense of possibility for moving forward. I think we've got to start telling more stories about how people are coming together, the successes they're having, also the failures they're encountering, and how they've picked themselves up and kept moving.
At this point, you know, we've just come off the government shutdown, as you said. A lot of Americans are incredibly disillusioned with the government. How are you going to convince them that it's time to reengage and start focusing on different things?
You know, it's interesting. About a year or so ago, I took a walk across the country and engaged Americans in very deep conversations about their lives, their hopes, how the country is going, how their community and their families are going. And, you know, it was interesting. One of the things that I heard from people time and time again, and this goes back to one of your earlier questions, is that Americans are yearning to reengage and reconnect with one another, not in the sense of coming back into public life into these kind of acrimonious and divisive debates where there's no winner and everyone loses, but where we can find a new pathway forward and actually generate positive action. I believe, not simply because I believe this, but because I've seen it in communities and I've heard people talk about it, that people are ready, but we've got to create different conditions within which people will step forward back into community life.
Now, I want to look at that first thing that you suggest we do, and that is focus on shared aspirations. It's so hard to get people to agree on anything. How do you propose people start to find that common ground?
Well, first, I would say that there's a basic question we can ask ourselves when we're together, and that is, what are our aspirations for our community? Now, notice I didn't say, what are the problems we face and who's to blame? I didn't simply say, what are your aspirations for your own family and yourself? I asked the question, what are our aspirations for our community? And what we find, you know, I just did this in an area called Asylum Hill in Hartford, Connecticut. And there, what folks said is we need a safer, more connected community. And the challenges there is that there's crime on the street, that the police, when they see groups of people coming together, they see them as loiterers and they push them off the street. And yet people said what we need to do is come back onto the streets, gather together, get to know each other, rebuild our trust, and do things together. If that was the aspiration for a community, that's something people share, it's something that implicates all of us in terms of taking action, and there are steps we can actually take to start moving towards those aspirations rather than remaining in these kinds of acrimonious and divisive debates that take us nowhere other than, as you're suggesting, to drive people back into their homes.
Do you think that by doing this, you know, it's possible to make a bottom-up effect? If people come together at this community level, will it kind of work its way up the food chain to Washington?
Well, if you look at American history, I think the great lesson of American history is that all change started small, whether it's the civil rights movement, women's suffrage, the abolition of slavery, I mean, any number of issues, or as in Asylum Hill, Hartford, the rebuilding of a neighborhood. But again, I think I just want to underscore for those who are listening, I think it is about citizens reengaging and reconnecting with one another. But I also believe that we need organizations and institutions. You know, you have one in Madison. The United Way of Dane County is a really good example of an organization that has turned outward toward their community, that is focusing on issues that matter in people's lives, and that is trying. I think they would say they're not fully succeeding yet, but that is trying to bring people together to take meaningful actions to help the community move forward. We need these organizations to help pull us together. We need the organizations to help organize us in many respects. We need their resources and their talents. So I think we're going to need to come together, citizens, organizations, leaders, institutions, in order to push this forward.
When you say come together, how organized is this? Are you talking about a few town halls or civic leaders? How do you see this sort of playing out, you know, at the ground level?
Well, you know, we're working in lots of communities where there is a process by which people, like Asylum Hill, Hartford, where people are actually going through a number of steps together. But I think what's important for today is that you don't need to wait for that. That in order for us, you know, what I hear people hungering for is that we need to restore our sense of belief in ourselves that we can actually come together and get things done. You can start that in your church or synagogue. You could start that in your neighborhood association. If you belong to a book club, you can start it in your book club. We don't need to wait for a big comprehensive process to get going, nor do we need to wait for some kind of permission from Washington, D.C., or our state capitals or our elected officials. People and organizations can start now, and I think we need to do that because as we begin to start and people start to see things happening around them, it sends signals to them that other people care, that they have compassion for one another, that people want to get up and do something, and that we want to make progress together. And those are the signals I think right now we need to send each other, because otherwise the signals we're getting are things like the government shutdown in D.C.
How do we start to tell different stories? That's an interesting one, because there is, you know, the negative stuff, the fighting and the backbiting and the yelling and the screaming, that's what makes news generally.
Right,
how do we
right.
tell different stories?
Well, you know, I often think of them as civic parables. And, you know, all parables are shareable, and they all sort of have an implicit lesson or moral to it, and they always implicate you, right? Like the religious parable of the Good Samaritan, there's no ending to that story. You could be that person being the Good Samaritan. And so I think the kinds of stories we need to tell are stories where some folks actually came together and they tried to do something. Let's say something as simple as painting a school. And they came out of their homes, they set a goal together, they started to move forward, they realized they encountered some challenges that were unanticipated, they sort of fell down or scabbed their knee, and they had to get back up and sort of brush themselves off, and ultimately they moved to some kind of success. I think we need to tell stories that have those elements in them. You know, the kinds of stories you might tell at your dinner table around a Little League field on a Saturday or a Sunday, or you might hear at church or synagogue, or you might tell it a book club. The problem right now is that we don't tell those stories enough to each other, and the stories we do tell are these negative stories, which tend to shape our mindset, our attitudes, our behaviors, our sense of belief, whether or not change is even possible.
In the last 20 seconds or so, how optimistic are you that America, at least on Main Street, can come together again and be a more cohesive place?
I'm really, I have no illusions that this is going to be easy, but it's rooted in my experience in communities. As I said earlier, I think there's a hunger in the country for people to reengage and reconnect. We want to help catalyze and trigger that and demonstrate and help people see that there's a different path forward. And I feel really good about the possibilities for making this happen.
All right. Well, Rich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thanks, Veronica.
That was Rich Harwood, founder and president of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation.
And if you have a story like the one Rich was just talking about, share it with us on the Central Time Facebook page, Central Time on WPR, or email centraltime@WPR.org. Maybe it's something we can talk about on a future show. Coming up next is the news, and then we'll check in on a new bill in Wisconsin focused on safety for bicyclists, pedestrians, and other vulnerable users of the state's roadways.
You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is Central Time WPR. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.